Jason won that match against Shane, and Shane's a king, and he went up and stood in his chair. You don't stand in the king's chair.
Demi, I'm pretty sure we're going to start kicking you off the podcast. You're not going to be part of the podcast anymore because you make us record too early in the morning, and I don't want to be up this early. I'm grumpy in the morning.
Man, you're telling me I'm a night owl, man. If we could do this, I'd rather do this at 2 in the morning. I'd be in peak flow, baby.
Well, we have to change it to the morning because of you. Rob, isn't that terrible?
Yeah, whatever, Nate. Let's go.
Wow. Speaking of grumpy, woo. Yowzers.
Yeah.
All right, we better get going before Rob really just tears into us. So we can start off with thanking the new Patreon supporters that we had this week, and there are four, which is awesome. So thank you to Morgan Lupton, who I met at the Moscone Cup this year and got to party with for a couple days. So thank you, Morgan. Tim Clark, he has been one of the biggest supporters of the podcast since the beginning. He always shares the podcast like crazy. So thank you, Tim Clark. And swing by the booth this weekend at State and collect your prize. Tozar Hammond, I hope I pronounced that right. Thank you very much. And Russell Hendley, thank you as well. I don't know either of you two, so I can't give you special little intros, but I do know the other two. I reached out to Tozar and Russell on Patreon, and maybe if you log back into your Patreon, you'll see that message. And if not, what I'll do is I'll probably just switch over to Facebook and see if I can't find you guys there. You guys have some prizes that are coming for becoming part of the Patreon. And of course, we had our first shipment of the prizes that we will be giving away soon from McDermott, and I will be getting another one this weekend for Jacoby Custom Cues. So starting in March, we will start giving away some of the prizes for the Patreon supporters. So you still have time to head over there and get entered in for that. And on top of that, so I've decided what I'm going to do for the very first thing that I'm going to basically use from the Patreon support. I am going to basically buy a video camera, a nice high quality video camera. And what I'm going to do is the YouTube page for the podcast now, I have been uploading all of the podcasts to that. And it's just basically to a black background that doesn't really, you know, there's nothing really to look at. But what I'm going to do going forward is I'm going to, with the video camera, I'm actually going to record myself just practicing pool. You know, I practice pool a decent amount anyway, so I think it'd be a good idea to just put that as like a background for the playing of the podcast on YouTube. And, you know, there'll be no audio or anything like that. It'll just be the podcast, but it'll give you something to watch if you wanted to watch on YouTube. So that'll be an option going forward.
We have to watch you then?
Yeah. Well, I'll get to that in
There's
one second.
There's no other option?
There is going to be another option. So what I'm going to do as another thank you to the Patreons in the future is I'm actually going to make that background instead of myself or maybe Rob or Demetrius. I'm going to make that actually open to some of the Patreons that support the podcast. And basically you get to be the background of you practicing pool or doing drills or whatever you want to do as the background for some of these videos. So
yeah, not whatever you want to do though.
Pool related, ideally.
There are lines drawn in the sand on this one, Nate.
Pool related, ideally, of course. So, if any of the Patreons are interested in that and being the background for one of the podcasts, absolutely, we'll be reaching out and creating some sort of group in the future with all of the Patreons that this is going to be an option for. So, just know that will be available
like
in
fun.
The future as well.
I might want to be a Patreon for
just
that.
So you can be that. Yeah. Right. All right.
Right.
Well,
I've never been the backdrop for anything.
Is there a second level of support I can provide to where I overrule Rob as a background?
Are you saying that you want crazier backgrounds?
No, I was wondering if I could outbid him and keep him off the background.
Yes.
I don't know. No, I'm just kidding. I'd love to see some of his sweeping seven rails billiard mass A shots. So
yeah, that'd be fun watching Rob play some billiards. We're gonna have to set that up for you, Rob. That'll be fun.
Yeah, well, I got my homemade 9-foot table. It was a 9-foot Gandy, commercial Gandy that I had at the pool hall, and they banked real good. I always liked the table. They played a little easy. The pockets were pretty easy on them, but I turned that Gandy into a 9-foot billiard table. Made some rails for it, and they turned out pretty nice. They don't look the greatest because I'm not the greatest carpenter, but they function real nice. And if you want a convertible 9-foot pool table, a Gandy, I can put the other rails back on and put the pockets in without any problem at all with that.
That reminds me, the pool hall I grew up in, we had 11 normal pool tables, and we had one billiard table in the corner. And a commercial place, we'd always have these new people would come in on Saturday nights. They'd come in big groups, guys and girls and college kids, and they'd come in and they'd always want that table in the back corner because it was out of the way. And
yeah,
that was the billiard table. So they'd get a rack of balls and they'd all go back there like they'd just beeline back to the billiard table. And we'd always wonder how long it would take until they realized there was no pockets, right?
Yeah.
And so usually and it was always funny to watch them react to, because of course, they never knew such a thing existed. And so some of them they'd get back there, then they'd turn and come back to the counter and kind of ask us questions. Other people would actually take off their jackets and get everything put together and grab their cues and be rolling around the table. Then they'd look kind of confused. But they'd always come up and they'd always be like, excuse me, that table doesn't have any pockets, like there's a fly in their soup. And then our favorite,
there's
thing, we
a problem
actually saw,
with it.
We actually saw one group, they actually racked the balls, they broke the balls, and one of the guys was walking around with his cue stick looking at the layout trying to figure out what shot he wanted to shoot, and he actually got as far as like walking around the table looking at the table until he finally figured it out. And so anyway, it just a little flash down memory lane.
I can, and this is just a few years ago, some of the listeners might find this interesting or cute, or it's just plain stupid, which is what it was. But it was 4 years ago I took up three cushion billiards, and I really didn't know a whole lot about it. But I got asked to go to a pool tournament in Milwaukee at Romine's there. And so I went. And there's all these guys there. There's a dozen guys there that show up, and they all can play. And I'd never played before, really. I didn't have a billiard table to shoot on or anything. So I was raw, brand new. Really never played three cushion billiards before, and I get in a tournament. So I'm standing by the table and I'm thinking, boy, that's got that diamond light above the table that's just really bright and perfect. It's as big as the table almost, and I'm holding my hand up to it and going, man, that's really warm. That light's so warm that the cloth is warm.
Oh, you thought it was the light.
So the next guy I'm playing, he gets up there, and then my opponent happened to be Gary Yeeke, a guy from Wisconsin. And I said, gee, look at this, Gary. I said, and I just met him. I didn't know him, but this light is so warm. It's warming the cloth up. And he looked at me, and he goes, really? And I went, what do you mean, really? What kind of an answer is that? He goes, Rob, the slate is heated. Oh, I said. And this is just 4 years ago now. So
yeah.
I'm 67 years old, 4 years ago. I've been around pool all my life. And in the back of my mind, of course, I did know that they had heated slates, but I'd never seen a table that had heated slate or played on one. And, well, how wonderful, of course, for hands that are starting to get arthritic.
Ooh,
and crampy. And every time I put my hand on that table, it was like a sliced piece of cheese.
It's like having a kitten on your lap, yeah.
I'm cold. Give me a kitten. Where's my cat? Bring my cat over here. Let him sit on me. But, yeah, and so, I did feel stupid, and then I did feel stupid when I made a good shot during the tournament. I heard a bunch of that, like people snapping their fingers and clicking sounds. And, of course, I had no idea what that meant. But that's how billiard players applaud when they see somebody make a good shot. They don't yell.
It's a crazy parallel universe, You just have to kind of...
Oh, my God.
Afternoon. Yeah.
Oh, my God, it is. And so I experienced two things there. I experienced the stupidity of not knowing something that was pretty obvious to everybody else. And I experienced getting applauded and not knowing what it was.
It seems very fitting that you would do something like that, Rob. It just seems fitting.
And you know what? one of the matches I lost was to the player who won, which was Craig Powers, who was a very good three cushion billiard player and pocket pool player. And I only lost by three to him. It was, I think we were just going to 15, but it was like 15 to 12. So that was, and never playing before, I was, but I had a lot of shots that I knew from like a four railer in pool. I mean, yeah, you know that from the time you start out playing
pool.
Yeah,
the quote-unquote pool billiard shots. Yes. Cue ball patterns. The other thing about that game is it's so streaky. You hit a few billiards, and it's like, I always wondered, and maybe you could tell me, Rob, if you, it feels like when I play billiards, if I score a point, I tend to, like, I have runs of two and three.
Absolutely.
Or I go through long stretches of zeros.
With
and
nothing.
It seems like my app.
And
like,
why is that?
If you could take my
There's
average,
a reason for that.
But if you could take the average, my average score after having scored my first point, I might average one. But if you take
right.
my average score after a miss, I might average 0.2. And it seems
yeah.
like it's just so streaky. Why
yeah.
is that?
Well,
you said there's a reason?
Yes, there is a reason for that. Is that when you're shooting the shot, you're actually should be thinking a little about where's the object ball going to go. When your opponent's shooting the shot, he's thinking about where he wants it to go bad for you.
So you're not really playing shape, but you're not trying to deliver. You're kind of
exactly.
nudging. You're kind of nudging towards good position. They're
and you get up against players who play defense all the time.
Yeah.
And so
true.
Every time you're at the table, all you guys are very difficult shot with your ball at one end of the table and the other two balls at the other end of the table. Well, if you don't know some ways to manage those tougher situations. If you don't know the solutions for those and have practiced them, I spend hours. I probably spend at least 12 hours a week trying to get out of, you know, trying to find solutions for hard situations where I can actually now have a 50% chance of making a point, which
well, that,
is
that,
huge rather
that
versus
sense.
A 0% chance.
Yeah, you got to be able to kind of come, like in pool, you got to kind of come with that first shot. But the other thing, Rob,
once you get the first shot, then all of a sudden the balls end up a little better.
I think it's a momentum thing, though, too, because after you score a point, you get a little pep in your step, you get a
yep.
little feel, a little confidence. It just seems like,
yep.
yeah, but I think you're right. I think that definitely, I know that I don't play a lot of billiards, but even I know, you know, to play easy to, you know, hard away from the red, try not to leave them next to each other. I try to play my bands. If I'm coming off the other
yep.
guy's cue ball, I try
not
to play
so much
it to the opposite
different
end rail.
Than pocket pool in regard to having momentum. It seems that games all through the game will flow a certain way, and same in pocket pool.
We can wrap that discussion up there, and we can move on to this week. Obviously, Wednesday, I am going to be leaving for the Wisconsin State Pool Tournament. I will have a booth set up. So for all of the Wisconsin listeners, you probably already know this at this point, but I will have a booth there, and we will have sweatshirts. We will have t-shirts. We will have the towels that I showed off on Facebook yesterday, which turned out to be a great response. Lots of people wanted those, so swing over to the booth. I have a pretty decently large amount of them, but they might sell out. So if you wanted one, make sure you're not dawdling as far as getting over there to get them, because if they sell out, I don't have any more available anytime soon. So yes, of course, that's swing over to the booth at some point in time. And if nothing else, just to say hi, and we'll have some stuff set up for recording, actually. So swing over to the booth and I'll show you what we can do as far as some recording so that you could actually be part of the podcast going forward, which is fun. And so with that, we can wrap it up with all the announcements in the beginning. We can move on to shout-outs. Rob, would you like to go first?
Well, this is a little explanation. I don't know if many of the listeners out there realize what the WSPA in Wisconsin is. It was a group of people that ran the BCAPL tournament in the state of Wisconsin at one time. And they decided that they no longer wanted to, you know, send 12 of the $15 to an organization that only gave them so much back for a state tournament. So they fractured off and started their own association, which doesn't have a national tournament. It's just a state pool league association tournament. And all the money that you pay for your sanction fee, I believe it's $8. Am I wrong there? Could
it's
it $10. Be 10, Nate?
Yeah, it's $10.
It's 10 now?
Yep.
That pretty much all goes back in to run the tournament and goes into the prize fund. So they essentially removed the the head guy. But you can't, there's no national tournament for it. But anyhow, so it's dollar cents wise, it's kind of the right thing to do for pool players. Yeah, I'm going to shout out to WSBA for fracturing off from the BCAPL and starting an organization that is really for the pool players and benefits the pool players practically 100%, probably, you know, 90%, I'm sure.
Gotcha. All right, Demetrius, would you like to go next?
Yeah, there's a gentleman I'd like to shout out, someone I don't even know personally, but it is, John Chaplin from Oregon. So John apparently got wind of what I'm doing as far as the pool training, and he wasn't, he wasn't the one that came out, but he ended up knowing somebody else that needed some good high-class pool instruction, and he was able to connect this person with me, and I was able to get together with a friend of his, and boy, did we have a transformative experience. This gentleman is super thrilled with what we were able to do for his pool game. And I think it's pretty amazing when I love referrals. It's really special and meaningful to me. And to get a referral from someone I don't even know to just kind of share, pay it forward, pass it forward, whatever. I just wanted to say thanks. So John Chaplin, thank you very much. And I hope we can cross paths sometime on the table.
All right, and I will wrap it up. My shot will go to the Whitewater pool team, who I went down on Friday and did some just volunteer coaching, I guess. I just showed up and just helped out with some of the players who were down there. And so Noah, Sarah, and Trevor, big shout out to you guys for showing up. And it was a pleasure getting to work with you guys. And I don't know if Trevor listens to the podcast, but I'm sure Sarah and Noah will hear this. And yeah, so with that, we can move on to the podcast. So we will talk about what happened last week with Francisco Bustamante and Justin Bergman. And I guess we were correct on the podcast, all three of us. Francisco Bustamante wins 2-1. I didn't get the order right as far as 8-ball and 10-ball, but I kind of figured the one pocket would be a little bit of a runaway. I mean, Busty is a super talented one pocket player. I mean, one of the best in the world, definitely probably top three. Top five for sure in one pocket in the world. So that one was a little bit of an easier one for me, I think, and for all of us. But the 8-ball ended up at 25-21, which sounded a little bit closer than it was. Bergman was up, I think, 24-16, if I'm not mistaken, and Boosty went on a little bit of a rallying spree to get it close. But Boosty wins 8-2 in the one pocket, and then wins the final set 30-20.
So we got the 8-ball and the 9-ball and the 10-ball mixed up.
Yeah, yep.
With who would win what there.
Yeah, so any big takeaways that anybody has?
Why do you think that was? Why we all felt that Justin would win the 10-ball?
Well, I got to tell you. So I think that when I called Boosty, I did pick Boosty. He was my pick. But I also said that there's times when somebody's like a very, very strong favorite, and then there's times when you got a guy that's got an edge. I think Boosty had an edge. I don't think he was a prohibitive favorite. And so I think Boosty has an edge in the 8-ball. I think Boosty has a strong edge in the one pocket. But I think that 8-ball, he's maybe got a slight edge or it's very close. And in the 10-ball, maybe Bergman has a slight edge, but it's very close. And so when something's close, it can go either way. And what I think is that obviously, it could have gone the other way. He could have won the 8-ball and lost the 10-ball. Bergman could have beat him both shooting games. He could have beat him both the 8-ball and the 10-ball. And then I would have been wrong, quote unquote, wrong on my pick, except that if I can pick a guy who's a really, really strong favorite in one of the three events and who's even money at worst and the other two, then basically anybody that's going to bet against Berg, you know, anybody that's going to bet on Berg, you're kind of betting that you're going to win two coin flips in a row. And not only is that a long shot, but then psychologically, when he knows that he's probably going to lose the one pocket, he knows he's got to win and beat this guy Boosty two sets in a row. That's a big hill to climb for anybody. So bottom line, I really just feel like, it's not that, well, Boosty's for sure going to win the 8-ball. Boosty's for sure going to win the one pocket. Therefore, he's for sure going to win. It's like, no, it could have gone either way. Bergman obviously did a great job. Yeah, he beat him in the 8-ball. There's no question Bergman could have beat him in the 10-ball. Could have won that set. Anybody that bet on Bergman, I'm not saying they're stupid. They definitely could have gone that way. But it's just small edges that kind of add up.
Yep. I agree entirely. I think it was kind of like what I said last year. I think I broke down the percentages. I said about 70% Boosty to win the one pocket. And then I said about 55% I thought Boosty would win the eight ball. And I thought he was probably like a 40 to 45% dog Boosty was in the 10 ball. So, you know, there's basically coin flips between the 10 ball and the eight ball. And I think that's still true. I mean, Boosty had a little bit of a cushion with the 10 ball. And Bergman had a little bit of a cushion in the eight ball that ended up kind of deteriorating at the end. But, you know, I still kind of look at both of those matches as being pretty close to coin flips with small edges going one way or the other.
If they ran it again tomorrow, you could get a totally different result. Yeah.
I think the only thing that's going to be pretty close to constant is the one pocket.
I got a question for you, Demi, because you've played and know a lot of these pros that we talk about. Are there many of them that view the different genres of the game as a favorite, or they just don't care, or they like them all, or they lean toward, you know, one game more than another?
Yeah, certainly. What happens is every game has a set of skills that is most rewarded. So, For example, if you play one pocket, well, then having a big sledgehammer break is not going to be rewarded. And if you play, certain games, shot making might be more important, or certain games, you know, cue ball control or safety play might be more important. If you're playing one pocket, it's all about safeties and cue ball and maneuvering. Whereas when you're playing 10 ball on big pockets, it's more about shot making and running out. Not to say that they all, there's always some overlap, but I always think about that, every game has a different pie chart of which skills are favored to become a winning player. And so what happens is when somebody grows up, whatever games they play, they usually develop the skills needed to be dominant at the game they learn. And then when they go switch to other games, it's frustrating because the skills they've developed aren't being rewarded. And meanwhile, they're being penalized for not having skill. Like, for example, if you grew up without jump cues and then jump cues are introduced, then it might be frustrating because you haven't developed those skills at all. And all the skills that you've learned with kicking and safeties are seem like they're not being rewarded or they're being penalized.
Yeah.
And so people don't like jumping. So the bottom line is players develop their skills. And what I think a champion, here's the point though, what a champion does is they understand that different games require different skills. And they say, if I'm going to be a champion, that means I develop all of my skills so I can be successful with whatever turf we play on. And I think that's the key to being a champion. And I think Boosty is a great example of a guy that's so well-rounded that he can play all the games at a high level.
You know, I asked that question because I asked that question of Efren Reyes one time after a one-pocket match out in Vegas that he had. He was putting his cue away. And I just walked up to him. I says, you know, out of all the game you're great at, all the games you play pretty much, and what game do you like the best? You know, what game do you feel that you can really get out there and or you just like better? And he looked at me and he was a little confused. I think with what I asked him, because his answer was, well, I don't like any of them. And I went, really? I mean, you don't like playing? He says, I just play the games. So he's there to win and play for money and to make money. He doesn't like any of them, and that's pretty unusual. When I heard, I was really kind of taken back by that. You know, I figured, he'd say, well, I love them all. How can you not love what you do you're so good at? And so that was kind of interesting. And I've talked to a couple other quality players who've kind of said similar things. And it's got nothing to do with like for me, they said. Mm-hmm. It's just got everything to do with winning and making a living.
Well, it is interesting, but I'll like the games enough for all of us. How about that?
Yeah, well, there you go. I think that's not the rule. That's the exception for these players. But you do see that. I'm an emotional person, so I bring a little emotion to my pool game, which is not a good thing, really, in pool. But if I have a little bit of emotion and it's positive, then it's okay. It's a matter of training that, how much emotion you're going to put into the game. But I was getting some instruction by a three cushion player one time, and he was a good player from out of Chicago, and he was setting the shot up for me, and I kept shooting it and shooting it and shooting it, and every time I missed it, I'd kind of grunt a little bit, and he'd go, "What are you doing? What is that? What are you responding to there when you miss? The miss is just a factual thing that just happened. You shouldn't be having any emotion about that. You should be thinking about what you need to do so you don't miss and concentrating on that." And
wise words.
I thought about that and I went, "Well, you're right. But how do you get that emotion out of that? Out of the game? Because I love the game. So I'm going to care about every shot, right?"
Yeah.
So I guess that's a question for both you guys. I'll just throw it out there. Maybe the listeners would like to hear that.
So, yeah, I guess we can. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk about for getting back to the Fusti and Bergman matches? Is there anything else that you guys would like to talk about?
How fast did you play?
So I actually am going to discuss that. I was going to see if you guys wanted anything else before I address that.
No, I'm good.
So in the past, obviously, especially the last few episodes, we'd kind of gotten on Justin Bergman a little bit for his slow play, and kind of rightfully so from what we saw from the John Mora and Justin Bergman matchup. But so I actually, because of that, I actually didn't even buy this stream. I didn't want to watch it. I didn't really feel like I should support something like that. It's just not entertaining, really. And so a couple of the people that I talked to along the way said that Bergman was playing a little bit slow in the eight ball, but not terribly bad. And then the one pocket was pretty quick. I mean, it seemed like it was kind of a railroading from Boosty. But it was entertaining enough that I just couldn't keep myself away from it day three. So I did go over to Pool Action TV, get my, you know, $120 subscription to their 6-month package, and I went over and watched day three, and I was pretty impressed with how the pace of play from both players. Of course, Boosty has never been accused of being a slow player, and Justin Bergman was playing pretty quickly. I mean, he'd still get off to the side now and then and do his practice strokes where he wants the ball, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It's the important part is he's not getting up and down off of his shots 4 or 5 times. And so just because I feel like I should stay consistent, if Bergman is going to play slow, I need to call him out. And if he's going to play fast, I need to call him out. So the pace of play this weekend was very, very good from what I saw on day three. And I just feel like I should point that out as far as consistency. So here I am pointing it out.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the pocket size was obviously bigger. And I think that makes a huge difference in pace of play. And I also wonder if, you know, when Boosty, I mean, I wonder if Justin's at all influenced. You know, you think he's such a professional and so good, you think he'd just play his game and he wouldn't be influenced by his opponent. But if he's playing Boosty, who's just fast and loose, I wonder if that kind of just pulls his pace of play up towards the top a little bit more versus when he's playing Mora, who's real smooth and methodical, if that kind of gives him the feel that it's okay for him. You know, I wonder if he's influenced by his opponent at all, or if it's all just, you know, the pocket size and the fact that, you know, he could go ahead and just let his stroke out a little bit more on bigger pockets.
From what I watched on day three, man, he was pounding some of those balls. Like you could, I mean, he was really struggling to catch up with Boosie from the get-go. Boosty jumped out to a huge lead right away, and Justin was basically playing catch up the entire match from there. But you could definitely tell that Justin was trying to get himself into some sort of free swinging dead strokes kind of, you know, groove going on. And man, he was pounding some balls 150 miles an hour into pockets and just coming around four rails on positioning to get dead nuts perfect in the exact way we all know Justin Bergman can play. So it definitely seemed like he was trying to do exactly what you were saying as far as getting himself into a proper stroke and hitting the balls good. So we can wrap up the discussion there and we can move on to the one event that's basically happening, well, basically right now. So we'll talk about that coming up. So there's currently a matchup going on between Shane Winters and Alex Olinger, and this is for $20,000, and it is a best 2 out of 3 sets, and this is a very, very interesting format. So the first day is actually played today, with Tuesday the 25th. Day two is going to be, I guess, today, and it's going to be 10 ball race to 25, and if it goes 1-1, the tie-breaking set is a coin flip race to 25. So that is a pretty interesting format for this. So actually, unfortunately, by the time that you actually hear this podcast, or this matchup will probably actually be done, because there's a lot of post-production that has to happen to these episodes. And I, you know, usually it takes me about 4 to 5 hours to get these things out after doing the podcast. So I don't think that I can actually get it done today, which is the 25th, which is going to be the 10 ball race to 25. So I guess by the time that you hear this, this will already be concluded, but we'll talk about it as if it's not, because it technically isn't. And
is this all on a bar table?
Yes, this is all on a bar box, a diamond bar box.
Okay.
Yeah, what a 7-foot diamond look like.
Yep. And this was supposed to be a pay-per-view. Some stuff happened. Regardless, it's not anymore. I know the story, but it's not worth even going into on the podcast. So this is now basically a free stream, and there's a bunch of people that are just streaming it from their phones and set up from different vantage points. So it's pretty easy to find. Just head over to Alex Olinger or Shane Winter's wall, and usually they'll be tagged in it. So it's easy to find. It's a great matchup. And these two, I don't know what it is about these two, but they always play insanely close. When they played their last set, they played a best 2 out of 3 race to 25, and two of the three sets were 23 or 24 to 25. And no disappointment last night. Alex Olinger got to the hill 24 to 23 and broke dry, and Shane Winters ran out the last two racks to win 25 to 24.
He really did, huh?
So, I mean, the closeness of these two players is just crazy. They always play super close. So today is the 10 ball, so we'll talk about that after me telling basically the update of that match. I guess I always like Alex in all of these matches because I just really like Alex as a player. So my bias is coming in, but I like Alex to win the 10 ball tonight and force the deciding coin flip race to 25. What do you two think?
Boy. Okay. So here's what I'll tell you. I have not seen Shane Winters play much. Now I know a little bit about him. I'm not going to go into the things I know so much because whatever. But I know a little bit about him. I know Alex's game a little bit better. And of course, I got to see a lot of him play John Mora. I've played Alex. I've seen him play live a little bit more. So my take on it initially, very, 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 very close match on both games. That's my initial take. I actually feel like, you know, for Shane to win the 8-ball, I would think that, well, I would have thought that Shane, if I had to pick who's, you know, if I had to pick one to win each, I might have picked Alex to win the 8-ball and Shane to win the 10-ball originally. But here, I think it's really, really, really close. So I don't even like to say I've got a favorite. But here's what I will say. I think that they play really close. But in terms of career trajectory, I might have been inclined to give Alex, I probably would have sat this one out. I'd probably say, you know, this is a coin flip. I don't even want to bet on the match. But if I had to place a bet, I might have placed a bet on Alex for one reason only, which is I feel like Alex is on more of a career upswing. So I feel like Winters has been, you know, on the one hand, he's got a lot of experience. He's been around. He's proven himself. He's got a phenomenal, you know, established track record. So you could give him maybe some experience edge. But I feel that Alex, his game has really improved over the last 2-3 years, and he's on a major, he's been leveling up, and he's hungry to get better. Obviously played the Mora match. He's playing a lot of tournaments. I mean, I saw him at Derby. I saw him at Olathe. He's going traveling around playing all the time, and he's actively improving, playing big matches and trying to get better. And you can see that he's got his eye on the, you know, improvement. So I feel like just based on the fact that I think he's on a little bit of an upswing and has his goal set real high, that all other things being equal, I'd rather bet on the guy that's kind of on an upswing as opposed to the person that's kind of been like, well, this is where I can get with Poole, and I'll just kind of, you know, and that's not fair maybe to Shane, because I don't know enough about Shane. Maybe Shane has been, you know, where he's at for a while, and maybe he's got a little fire to say, you know what, I've been at this level long enough, and now it's my turn to get to the top. So maybe Shane's got a renewal of motivation and hunger that I don't know about. But I can't tell what's in somebody's brain, but what I can tell is what their established results and trajectory are. And I feel that Alex has been on a bit of an upswing. And so if I had to put down a bet, I would have probably just tossed it on Alex just because I feel like he's a moving and shaking right now. But all in, I think it's really, really, really close on both matches, and it's a fun one to sweat.
Yeah, I watched a couple games, and I don't know. I like Shane's approach to the table a little bit more so than Alex's. I saw Alex miss a couple in those four games. He missed two shots. So I like his approach. What I mean by that, his physical approach to the shots. So I like Shane.
Yeah. Well,
for that reason.
Yep. So I guess we can move on to the third set, and we can break down all of the analytics of what the coin flip race to 25 tiebreaker will look like. That was a joke. Yeah, we're not going to do that. But it is really neat that they're doing a race to 25 coin flip as a deciding set. That's like the definition of gamble, right?
So, flipping a coin to see who gets the 25 coin flips first.
Yes, yeah. It's a race to five.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Well, there you go. That is the gamble.
I thought you were going to see if they flipped to see if they played 8-ball or 10-ball the third.
That's what I thought, too.
No, they are literally flipping a coin.
So, race to 25. Had us both confused there.
Well, now I'm sorry, I gotta know, is there a strategy if you're playing a race to 25 coin flip? Like, you call tails more often, or who's, I don't even know. That's just,
That's why, this was my point of saying we're gonna break down the analytics of the race, the coin flip. I want to see Alex win just because I want to see it. It's gonna be fun.
Now we gotta pull for Alex.
Well, I think we do.
How much fun would that be? Just a race to 25 coin flips. That'd be fun. And it's, like I said, it's the definition of gamble.
We've officially, for once, I'm at a loss for words. I have absolutely nothing to add to this. I have zero idea what we're even... Good luck to
we're talking about gambling now.
Yeah.
We should get Austin Hill in this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be fun. We got to pull for Alex just so we can see this race to 25 coin flip. It'll be interesting to say the least. So I guess we can wrap up our discussion there, and we can move on to the end of the podcast. So we're going to skip over the discussion topic, and we are going to go into just wrapping up the podcast with some tips. So the two tips is we're going to go back to basically the two tip segment, which is going to be Rob and myself. And Demetrius's tip is kind of going to be the new segment that I'm going to introduce in a couple of minutes. So Rob, this will just be us for our two tips. Would you like to take it away first?
Sure, Nate. And I'm going to pat you on the back.
Woohoo!
For this one, because this was one of your tips that I just went, sure, that's a good tip. And I'm just going to re-say it because of how important it is. And this has got to do with the game of 8-ball, primarily, although you can break this down in other games too. Certainly straight pool you could apply this to, but for now, just 8-ball, and that is, you've got breaking the balls, you make a ball, you've got choice, you got 7 balls or 6 on the table, and you're going, oh boy, here I can make these 2 or 3 or this one here and there, and you're looking at the whole table, and you had said one time, okay, forget that, break the table up into parts. There's 3 balls over in that part of the table. Here's 2 over here in this part of the table. There's 2 over here in this part of the table. And then, of course, identify the worst shot you have, the hardest shot that you're going to have in that rack. And work the table in small groups of balls. And that seems to be a way to get to the end without cluttering your mind too much about what to do later on. And planning every single thing out. So I'm just going to reiterate your tip there about, shorter groups, 2 or 3 at a time for 8-ball.
All right. So my tip this week will be, and this is all kind of spawned from what I talked about in the beginning with the shout-outs. Down in Whitewater, I was doing some coaching, and one thing I kind of noticed from the people that are down there is I was working with them on different aspects of mechanics and basically just building a foundation on, you can't build a skyscraper on a crap foundation. So the most important part is just building the foundation of your game. And a lot of that comes down to your stance, which some people think that's super important. Stance is, in my mind, stance is not important at all. I mean, as long as you are able to stand sturdily into the shot, you're not messing around and falling down in between your shots, you have a good stern foundation, that's the only thing that matters in my mind. One of you two, maybe you want to disagree with that in a second, that's fine, but as long as your stance is sturdy, I don't really care how you stand on the shot. Your bridge hand is probably the most important part of your mechanics, in my opinion. Maybe your back elbow, you could make that argument, but if your bridge isn't good enough to get the cue, the shaft of the cue, to strike the cue ball in the proper way, it's everything breaks down from there. You can still have a broken stroke. We all know that one person that strokes in inside to outside or outside to inside and still is able to make balls even though their elbow just looks completely broken. And that's just because, you know, if you're coming through straight at the end of your stroke, that's really the only thing that matters. Of course, you would like to be straight the entire way, but as long as you're
Mike
coming
Davis
through straight.
Texas.
Yeah. So
look at that stroke.
I think the bridge hand is really, really important. So what I always tell people is, try to, you know, put your bridge hand solidly on the table and try to wiggle it around. Move, you know, flex the arms or flex the muscles in your arm as best you can and try to get your hand to move. If your hand is easily moved by, you know, small movements in your arm, you need to completely redo your bridge on your hand. And you gotta try to get as wide as you possibly can with the points of contact, meaning your fingers, your palm, your thumb, wherever it is, you need to get your anchors very wide and very sturdy. So I would say for my tip this week is get your bridge hand down on the table and try and move it around. If you're able to move it around easily, then you probably need to work on widening out your base, your bridge hand base, and getting it more secure on the table. So small little thing, but it does make a huge difference, I think, in your mechanics for the game. So with that, and so we can move on from there. And so starting this week, we are actually going to give Demi his own segment because you deserve it.
I'll take it.
Perfect. So we are going to be giving you your own segment going forward on the episodes. And it's basically just going to be your little corner to rant and talk about whatever you want to talk about, whatever you want to highlight for this week. And we're going to call it the Coach's Corner. Is that what we're going with?
That works for me.
All right. We're going to go with the Coach's Corner segment. So this is going to be the very first Why Don't You Take It Away?
Sounds good. My goal, guys, I want to talk to the pool players out there. I've been doing a lot of pool training, as you guys know, doing it full-time, mnpoolbootcamp.com. Anyway, so I've been doing a lot of training, and I keep running into things, and so I want to kind of take some things that I've run into and things that I'm hearing from players, how their perspectives, you know, and I want to bring some of these nuggets, if I can, to the pool playing community, and hopefully we can all kind of get better at this game. And so today, I wanted to kick off with some misconceptions about consistency. So every pool player I talk to that wants to improve, one of the things that almost everybody seems to say is, I need to be more consistent. And what happens, you know, I think the reason for this is because they have a really good day when they're playing their best and they're in the zone and they're flow and they're feeling good and they're rating packages. And they're just like, yep, I just want to be able to do that all the time. I just want to play more consistently at the top of my game. And that is their goal, which is fine. That makes sense. That's a fun goal. Of course, who doesn't want that? But the problem is that they misunderstand how pool improvement works and they misunderstand what's possible. And through that, because of that misunderstanding, they come up with an ineffective action plan and they end up costing themselves a lot of pain and struggling to get better. So here's what goes wrong is when they have that approach, when their goal is consistency, they're like, I already have the capability of playing well, so therefore I just need to do it more consistently. When the goal is consistency, without fail, the people that want to be more consistent conclude that the way to do that, it must be fundamentals. It must be, I already have the capability of doing this, so in order to do it more and more and more accurately, I just need to get my fundamentals tighter and tighter. It must be a fundamental issue that I'm not able to do this consistently. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a Coke bottle and I'm going to stroke into that Coke bottle for, you know, 100 times a day. And eventually I'll turn into a robot where I just don't make these errors. And it's just, you know, fundamentals, listen, their fundamentals are important. And there are people where, you know, maybe some effort on fundamentals could be part of a solution, but as it is, that's not really the road that's going to take you forward. So the reality is, I want to talk about the kind of players have ranges of performance because we're human. So we all have a range of performance. And so let's just say there's a player and he has a Fargo rate of 600, you know, so he plays at a strong AA, weak master level, whatever. He's a 600 Fargo rate. Well, he's not going to play exactly the same every day because we're humans. And some days we're really focused and hungry and motivated. And some days we fall into the zone. Other days we're irritable or distracted or just, you know, things, whatever reason, you know, who knows why, but we're human. We're not robots. And so if somebody is a 600 Fargo, there's usually a range of performance where he might play that level most of the time. Some of the time he might play as good as a 675 level. And some of the time he might play as poor as a 525 level. And so usually it's close to 600, but there's extremes. It's like a bell curve distribution. And 1% of the time he touches on that 675. And so the problem is there's no way that he could just tell himself, let's play my best all the time. That just doesn't, you can't force yourself to play in the top 1% of your range all the time. And then the other thing is, well, people, the reason why do people think that's possible? You know, we're humans, but they think it's possible because they think the pros do it. They think, well, the pros, that's what the pros do. That's why they're pros, is because they found a way to consistently play, you know, 700 Fargo rate speed all the time. But the answer is they're not consistent either. And so Mike Page with Fargo rate has done some videos and some really, really good explanations of this on AZ Billiards, is that the pros have a range just as big and they are just as inconsistent as the amateurs. The difference is that their skill level is so much higher that we don't notice the inconsistency as much. So for example, if Shane is an 825 Fargo, well, if his range goes plus or minus 75 points, then some of the time he's playing as good as 900, but even on his worst days, when he's playing 75 points below his average, he's still performing at a 750 Fargo rate level, which means he's still running tables and playing extremely well. And so when you're watching a guy like Shane or Dennis or Josh Filler, all these guys at the absolute top, it looks like they're very, very consistent because they never play anything other than professional speed. But the actuality is that there's still a huge range, and that they did not get there by perfecting their fundamentals and playing perfect all the time. They developed their skills to a point to where even on their bad days, it still looks pretty darn impressive. And so the conclusion, and I've got a couple examples, so this isn't the end, but the conclusion is this. It's not about improving consistency, and it's not about improving fundamentals perpetually to achieve this impossible goal of consistency. The goal has to be to develop your skills so that your entire range lifts. So if you're a 600 and you want to play 675 consistently, then you need to actually develop your game so that the high part of your range is up in the 700s so that you play 675 most days. And if you want to get to where you play 675 every day, well, then you need to develop your range, you know, really, really high so that even your worst days are at that level. The only way to get to a level consistently is to develop your entire skill, to develop your skills, to push your entire range of play forward. And so I'm going to give you a couple of examples that hopefully really drive this home. So the first example is I have a thought experiment. Suppose there's a guy that has a 5-ball run that he practices. He's playing 9-ball. He's got to shoot him in order, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and he gets to take ball in hand and try to run these balls out. Okay. He knows how to make the 5 and get on the 6, but he has no idea how to pocket the 6 and get on the 7. Completely lost. He's like, I just don't know how to get from the 6 to the 7. So what he can do, though, is he knows that if he just plays a stop shot of the 6, he's dead hooked on the 7, but he can try to jump over the 9. Yeah, he just has a jump. I'll just accept the jump shot because I have no idea how to get shape. I will accept this jump shot on the 7-ball. But then if he can make that jump shot, the 8-9 is pretty easy. So every day he practices this 5-ball run. And every day he makes the 5, makes the 6, tries to jump in the 7-ball, and then run the balls out. And let's just say that he can make that jump shot 20% of the time. And to keep it really easy, let's say that he never misses any of the other balls. He always makes all the balls. He jumps in that ball 20% of the time, which means he runs this rack, this 5-ball run, 20% of the time he runs these 5 balls. Great. And now he decides, man, I've been practicing this. I'd really like getting better at this run out. I'd really like to improve this run out. How do I do that? Well, in his mind, he's like, well, I make all the other balls. I seem to miss this jump shot. Therefore, I need to improve my jump shot skills. That's the answer. And so he goes to work on this jump shot. He's practicing this jump shot hours and hours and hours, trying to find a way to lift up his jump percentage. And he's thinking, it must be a fundamental issue. I can make this jump shot some of the time. If I could jump this ball in every time, then I would run out every time and I'd be the best in the world. So therefore, it must be something with my back arm. I must be trembling. I must not be sighting it right. I need to work on my jump shot and my fundamentals, and then eventually I'll run these balls out every time. But little does he know, little does he know that the best jumpers in the world are only like 30% to make the seven ball jump. And so he can sit there and practice and practice and practice, and maybe his runout percentage goes from 20% to 22% to 24% over years of painstaking jump practice. But on the other hand, if he learned a new skill, such as a way to get from the six to the seven to work around that jump shot, maybe he could find a route that's, you know, 90% to give him a shot, and that he can make almost every time. Maybe he can run out 80-90% of the time. And all of a sudden, by learning a new skill, instead of painstakingly pounding your head against the wall for years and years and years, trying to creep up by 1 or 2%, by learning new skills, you could transform that whole runout experience and achieve a level of consistency that's actually much, much higher. And I'll tell you, the one other quick example I've got, and I've seen this come up too, because a lot of players in my area play bar table eight ball. And I've had people tell me this. They say, you know I can run tables because I have days where I can run, you know, I've run multiple tables and I've run a couple racks in a row. And I've had times when I run tables, but then a lot of days I don't. I just need to be more consistent. And I'm like, no, because what happens is the same type of thing. If you have an eight ball player that runs out 10% of the time, well, let's think about this. Out of 100 breaks at eight ball, you know, maybe you've got 60 of them that are average, you know, a lot of balls open, a couple balls tied up. You've got 20 of them that are really easy where all the balls happen to be open and sit in front of holes. And then you've got 20 of the racks that are really tough where there's multiple clusters, lots of congestion, just not really a good to get starter. And so if somebody's running out 10% of the time, they're not running out each of those, you know, they're not running out 10% of the time from each of those different starting opportunities. What they're doing is they're waiting for the bottom 20%, the easiest 20%, where all the balls are wide open, sit in front of holes. And then half that time, they're stumbling through the rack and able to get out. And so if they're a 10% eight ball runout player, you know, you can't just sit there and say, well, I know how to run tables, therefore, I don't know why I can't do it more often. It must be my back arm. Like, no, you're stumbling through the easiest 20% and barely getting there. What you need to do if you want to run out 50% of the time or 60% of the time is you're actually going to have to develop your skills to overcome some of the challenges, such as short side shape and tight quarter position and breakouts and all these things. You're going to have to develop your skills to be able to run out through some of the more difficult racks, because then if you develop your skills, you'll run out more of the easy racks and you'll actually start getting up in the high branches and picking the high hanging fruit and start picking up some of the more difficult racks as well. So it's all about developing your skills, not about saying, well, I proven I can do this, therefore I need to do it every time. Therefore it's consistency. It's my fundamentals. I got to start mapping out how I stand on my shots, and it must be about my foot placement. That must be the path to everything. So I'm not trying to say that fundamentals aren't important, but I think that this idea, you know, everybody has a best day. But the idea that because we have a good day once in a while, we must play this game right and we must play this game correctly, and it must just be about consistency, and it must therefore be about fundamentals, and then spending years and years and years, you know, beating our head against the wall, trying to understand why we're not suddenly able to play our best every time. Like, I want to rescue you people from that trap. The real answer is you need to develop your skills. You're not good enough. Your best day is not good enough. You need to develop your skills so that your best day gets better and better and better and drags your average day up with it. That's the only way to go. And then you're going to ask me, well, okay, if it's not fundamentals, what are those skills that I need to develop? Where should I be focusing on if it's not my back arm? And the answer is, I don't know. I don't know what skills you need to develop. I don't know what it is because I don't know you and I haven't seen you play. But I can tell you, at least if you're asking that question, what should I be developing? What are the skills that I need to add to my game to take me to the next level? At least if you start asking that question, at least you're on the right track now and you're not completely just spinning your wheels. So why don't you start with that question? What skills do you need to develop for your best game to get quite a bit better? Why don't you start with that question and see if you can actually make some progress? And if you need help, then I'm at minnesotapoolbootcamp.com, and that's what I do. Is you come, I take a look at how you play, and like Conor McGregor says, I'll change your bum pool life. So there you go.
All right, that'll always be available. Of course, we're going to continue doing this pretty frequently, I think, going forward for the podcast, so that a lot of people can get little tidbits and how I guess the coach thinks on these things. So Demi, thanks for that good long rant. Anybody likes this going forward, make sure to head over to mnpoolbootcamp.com and check it out and see if it's right for you. But other than that, we can close out the podcast. Perfect. So thank you guys again for joining me this week. And till next week.
Till next week. We'll meet again. Same time.
Take care, boys.
Same station.
Hey everyone, thanks again for listening. If you like what you've heard and you listen through iTunes, please subscribe and leave a rating. It helps others find the podcast. As always, thank you to our sponsors, Jacoby Custom Cues, Cody's Q Therapy, Jeff Glaz's CBD for Life Global, the Wisconsin Billiards Hall of Fame, The Rocks Sports Bar and Grill, the IQ Practice Cue Ball, and the Wisconsin Pool Player Society. If you like what you hear, consider supporting the people who support the podcast. I would also like to take this time to thank Matt Kitzman, Robert Miller, Natasha, Kurt Elliott, Scott Doolian, Corey Smith, William Sutherland, and Mike Teasy for their help to market the podcast to a larger audience. Lastly, I would like to thank my cousin Andrew Mindham for his band Hey Captain Knight's music as segment and filler music to the podcast. If you like what you hear, you can find all of his music at heycaptainknight.bandcamp.com. And Knight is K-N-I-G-H-T.